Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Cardiac Imaging to Predict Cardiac Events in Heart Failure Patients with and Without Preserved Ejection Fraction, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Bernard Gersh, MBCHB, FRCP, Doctor of Philosophy, and James Udelson, MD. Dr. Gersh is a professor of medicine, Division of Cardiovascular Diseases, Mayo Clinic and Foundation, Rochester, Minnesota. Bernard Gersh, MBCHB, FRCP, DPhil, has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Ortho McNeil Janssen, Amersite, Abbott Laboratories, Merck & Company, GE Healthcare, St. Jude Medical, and Boston Scientific. Dr. Gersh does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gersh does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Udelson is an acting chief, Division of Cardiology, Director, Nuclear Cardiology Laboratory, Co-Director, Heart Failure and Transplant Center, Tufts New England Medical Center, Boston, Massachusetts. James Udelson, MD, has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Lantheus Medical Imaging and GE Healthcare. Dr. Udelson does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Udelson does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to educate clinicians on the use of myocardial imaging in heart failure risk evaluation. This activity is supported by GE Healthcare. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Bernard Gersh from the Mayo Clinic. And with me today is Dr. Jim Udelson, who is Chief of Cardiology at Tufts University Medical Center. And the title of our panel discussion is Cardiac Imaging to Predict Cardiac Events in Heart Failure Patients with and Without Preserved Ejection Fraction. Jim, maybe what we can do is kick off with the first three slides and just provide a background to this. And this slide is taken from the MATER 2 trial and the SCUD-HF trial. These were two trials of primary prevention for patients with left ventricular dysfunction and randomized to an ICD or no ICD. And what you can see in the MATER 2 trial, after 3 years, is only about 30% of patients had had a shock. And in the SCUD-HF trial, 21% had appropriate shocks at 3 to 4 years. So this means that in terms of the economics, about 10 million patients in the United States would probably qualify for an ICD based upon an ejection fraction, and that's $200 billion to healthcare costs. And of that, only about 20% of those devices go off. So Jim, I wonder if you'd look and comment a little bit on this slide, which really lists the substantial, actually, number of non-invasive techniques that have been used to risk stratify. And by risk stratify, I mean, can we refine our risk stratification so that we put in ICDs in patients that really utilize them?
That's right. It's I think the long list here really speaks to how difficult it is, each one looking at a slightly different physiologic parameter. And I think it's also important in this discussion to really refine what we mean or define what we mean by risk stratification. You know, there's risk stratification sufficient to get a paper published. We have a p-value and two curves that diverge in some way to some degree. But for this particular purpose, I think we're also talking about risk stratification to pick out an extremely low-risk group of patients, because if you're talking about a decision, and this is what we're talking about, is not potentially not putting in an ICD, you better be pretty sure that that person doesn't need one because the stakes are so high. So it's a little bit different than the usual risk stratification as we read journals.
Yeah, I mean, you're a nuclear cardiologist and an imager. And I mean, such a large amount of what you have done and your colleagues over the last 10 years is the sensitivity and specificity is this and that, and the positive predictive value is this, and the negative predictive value is pretty good at 85 or 90%,
right.
But it's not so good if you're in that other 10% when the endpoint is sudden cardiac death.
That's right, and I live most of my life in the heart failure world, and like you said, defibrillators get put in, many are not used, and you know, if we put in 10, one or two are used, maybe if we could put in 7 to get those one or two, but those other three, there better be almost a 0% event rate. So it's a challenge, a very high bar.
So if we look at these, I mean, T-wave alternans was met with a great deal of enthusiasm. It really did. I think there were great expectations, early data suggesting that this may be an effective form of risk stratification. But we've now got either three trials or sub-studies from these trials that have really shown on its own it's of very little value.
That's right. Well, it again speaks to the fact that risk stratification is one thing and using it to make decisions is a different step, and those trials were very important negative trials.
So the same applies, heart rate turbulence or heart rate variability didn't pan out. Baroreflex sensitivity didn't pan out. QRS width is a non-specific marker of risk. The signal average ECG looked great 15 years ago, but it hasn't stood the test of time. I do know that the combination of T-wave alternans and heart rate turbulence has shown to be quite a powerful predictor, and Dr. Derek Exner, I think, in Calgary, is doing a randomized trial based on that at the moment. So we're really left with the two other modalities there, iodine-123 MIBG imaging, which you're going to talk about, and then the very interesting concept of MR imaging of the infarct zone and perhaps identifying an arrhythmogenic substrate that you could treat with catheter ablation. Jim, before we go into your area, would you just comment on that? I know this is work being done at Hopkins at the moment.
Right. So the idea is that you might be able to image the substrate and the variability of the myocardium and fibrotic substrate, and that should theoretically provide a signal to pick out high-risk people. And on the other hand, if you have very homogeneous myocardium without delayed enhancement, without areas of fibrosis, perhaps that is a very low-risk person.
And I think, wearing my electrophysiologist hat, if you identified a heterogeneous zone, areas of normal myocardium fibrosis, that could be the substrate for a re-entry arrhythmic circuit, you could make it homogeneous by ablating it.
You theoretically could.
And then I have up there the statement genetic approaches with a question mark. And the reason I do that is not to decry the role of genetics. I mean, there is no question that there is a familial tendency to sudden cardiac death. This has been shown in a study called the Paris Prospective Study. But the reason I put a question mark there is I think the genetics of sudden cardiac death is a clinical tool, or we are years away from that.
So, that's right. And we've seen in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy that the early reports didn't necessarily
didn't pan out. It didn't pan out in a group of non-related families. So tell us about iodine-123 MIBG imaging and why there's so much interest in this, and tell us about the technique and what it actually does.
Well, similar to some of the other techniques that are up there, you are imaging a potential substrate for arrhythmias. In other words, you can think of it simply as imaging the innervation of the heart and for the functional innervation. And this slide looks at some images. On the left is a patient with normal uptake, and this is very very simple. You inject the tracer, it's taken up to reflect sympathetic innervation. And what you see here on the left panel, it is just a simple planar image where the dark area of the heart, there's some lung uptake, some in the liver, and the measurement that's commonly used is called the heart mediastinal ratio, where you draw a region of interest around part some uptake in the myocardium, and you draw a region of interest, as you see, in the upper mediastinum, and you create the HM ratio, which normally, in this particular case, it says 2.2. The middle panel is a class 2 heart failure patient, and you can even visually see the lower amount of uptake representing some degree of functional sympathetic denervation. And on your right is a patient with advanced class 4 heart failure with a very low ratio and virtually visually absent almost uptake.
From a pathophysiologic, almost theoretical aspect, why does the failing heart denervate? Is it increased sympathetic tone that leads to downregulation of beta receptors, or?
Well, I think it's in part that in heart failure. In this slide is an example. In myocardial infarction, of course, it's damage to the nerve terminals. And in the post-MI setting, these are polar maps from a study done in Germany several years ago, where the white area is abnormal. And if on the bottom left, the white represents the area at risk from the myocardial infarction, the middle represents the final infarct size, and the lower right represents the defect, the whited out area is the defect on MIBG imaging. And this sort
it's
of
much larger than
it
the
is input. It is, and this mismatched area where the area of denervation, and this probably represents structural damage to the nerve terminals, that is larger than the infarct size, identified a group of patients that were at higher risk for arrhythmias going
and
forward.
And I don't know if you want to get into this later or whether I should ask you the question now, but in terms of non-ischemic patients, patients with heart failure, what would be the mechanism there of sympathetic denervation?
It probably has to do with beta receptor down-regulation.
Due to increased sympathetic tone and reduced stroke volume.
And neurohormonal activation, yeah. Of course. And so years ago, this agent actually has been around for quite some time, and the seminal papers, I think, came out of France in the late 1990s, and this particular slide shows a very high-profile paper from Merle and colleagues where a large group of heart failure patients were studied with MIBG, heart mediastinal ratio was calculated, and then they were followed over time for outcome events. And what you see here is that the patients, the solid line represents patients with a more preserved heart mediastinal ratio, and you can see that their survival, event-free survival, was really quite excellent, whereas those with an abnormal ratio in the dashed line, you know, had a very, very unfavorable outcome.
But, I mean, that's fine, but obviously if the upper line also reflects that they had an ejection fraction of 50% and the other patients that had abnormal innervation had an ejection fraction of 30%, then I'd sort of come back and say, well, what have you told me that I don't really know?
That's right, and that's important. In this study, a multivariable analysis showed that the MIBG heart mediastinal ratio was the most powerful predictor of outcome, even accounting for the simpler things that we
that's
know.
That's really important to
yes.
bring up.
And here are just simple sensitivity specificity values for various parameters that we would think are important in predicting outcomes in heart failure. And as you can see, the combination, really, of sensitivity specificity in this study was highest for MIBG.
Yes, it is.
Now, if you look at the citation, this was published in 1999. The patients were studied in the early 90s, followed throughout the 90s. So this, no ACE inhibitors, no beta blockers. So both of them can change the parameters, of course, because sympathetic tone goes down, neurohormonal activation is blunted, the whole heart failure syndrome changes. So this was very intriguing, but it wasn't entirely clear whether it was applicable to the contemporary practice of heart failure. And so it was really important to think about that as the field moved forward.
So now, I see, is this a nuclear cardiology phenomenon that all of this appears in the nuclear cardiology journals?
Well,
is there any reason why you don't publish this in one of the wider red journals?
Well, it's actually a really interesting point. I think, you know, I live in both worlds, and I think people in heart failure tend not to be that interested in imaging in general. But on the other hand, you can say, well, fine, you stratify risk, but what can I do that's different than I'm going to do anyways? And that's that follow-up question. There's not always an answer to that question. So
the key answer to that is when this technique or others or combinations thereof can predict when they have a negative predictive value of 100%,
mm-hmm.
that you can say to the patient, you are not going to need a defibrillator, then there will be widespread interest.
That's right. That's right. And so there was a few years ago, there was a very intriguing, very small study, again published in a nuclear journal, just 17 patients who had ICDs, and among those patients, the combination of MIBG data representing sympathetic innervation and heart rate variability analysis, if both of those were on the favorable end of the spectrum, that identified a group of patients who had no defibrillator discharges during a year or two of follow-up. Now, that is a very small number of people to hang your hat on.
17 patients. Yeah.
But it's just the beginning, but it gets back to your point about the combination of parameters that look at different pieces of the physiology may get you to a place where you could start then set up a trial to say, okay, let's maybe not put in defibrillators, but again, a high bar.
And it would be very interesting to look at it in ischemic and non-ischemic.
That's right. And this was too small to really separate that. So the other recent news along these lines is, in essence, a much larger contemporary update of the Merlet data that I showed a couple of minutes ago in a trial called ADMIRE-HF, with the idea, asking the question, did the MIBG data hold up in the contemporary treatment era?
And how many patients in the big ADMIRE trial?
Now, this is over 900 patients at multiple centers.
We're getting up to real numbers now.
And I must say, it's conceivable going in. I mean, I think there was a real sense of equipoise, at least on my part, that it could be when people are on ACE inhibitors and beta blockers that it didn't work anymore. So it really was important to show. So this slide looks at the main result here.
You actually raise a very interesting point in regard to any of these tests. I was involved in a number of studies that we carried out at the Mayo Clinic probably 15 years ago on signal average electrocardiography. And the signal average, an abnormal signal average ECG, appeared to be pretty predictive of outcomes in patients with myocardial infarction. Now, this was more than 15 years, about 20 years ago. So it looked like a predictor after MI of outcome. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was the reperfusion era. And then suddenly now everybody is going out with an open artery, a better preserved LV function, and the positive predictive value of a signal average ECG just fell away. The negative predictive value was still good because mm-hmm. the patients weren't getting any events. Yeah. But it wasn't the test. It
right.
was a different group of patients.
That's
it's
right.
sort of Bayesian principles mm-hmm. in a way. So when you had a group of people with a 30% event rate, sort of intermediate that's probability right. of mm-hmm. events, a positive test told you a lot, and a negative test told you a lot. But now we were dealing with people with a 5% event rate, and the test fell away.
So it is. That's
so
exactly right.
It is a reasonable argument to make, and that is, well, maybe these data won't hold up in the era of the beta
right.
blockers and ACE inhibitors.
That's right. That's to me was the importance of this trial, that it ultimately showed, as shown on this slide, that there is still risk stratification value, that the patients with the more preserved heart mediastinal ratio had a lower event rate than those with the more abnormal heart mediastinal ratio. But again, notice here that the patients with the favorable ratio didn't have a very low event rate, but this was a composite endpoint, sudden death, heart failure, three elements to the composite.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the x-axis, I mean the y-axis, mm-hmm. I mean, what you would say based on this is, look, the good news is you only have a 15%
mm-hmm. That's right.
likelihood of having, is the event is heart failure progression or arrhythmia or cardiac
right.
death.
That's right.
You say, well, the good news is you've got a 15% chance of that, and the bad news for the other people is that you've got a 35%, 37%.
That's right. And so as a clinician, what will you do? What do you make of that? When you look on this slide at the individual pieces of the composite, there's some intriguing data. On the middle left are the arrhythmic events, and presumably those are the ones that would help you make a decision about perhaps not putting in a defibrillator, and you can see a group that begins to look like very low risk.
Yeah,
but,
it does.
But
I
again,
mean, what is that at 3 years or so? This is middle left, so this is arrhythmic events. Probably under 10%.
It is. It could be. And again, the number of events is small, relatively small, out of this group, even of 900 patients, because as you said, contemporary practice, picking out a particular event like that, that's not a high rate in these people, but
What's also interesting is the cardiac death rate. I mean, it's very low.
It's very low. And so you begin to get the sense that it might be possible to use this to start to make some decisions in the future about defibrillators, listing for transplant, and if you could use a combination, as you were talking about this and something else, perhaps heart rate variability, maybe you can get an event rate that was so low.
So I was actually going to ask you that. It looks promising, but it needs more. And what would you then pick as the first other risk stratifier that you would put in combination?
Well, I think
heart rate turbulence, heart rate variability,
one of those. I'm not an electrophysiologist, but I think something that represents the electrical expression of the substrate. Again, maybe very simply based on that very small study in the past, because at least there's some data. And then you just have to look at it carefully and follow the patients to see if you can pick out a low-risk group.
Theoretically, that's very attractive. There is the concept of the arrhythmia triangle, which is at the apex of the triangle is a substrate. To the left, you have modulating factors. Number one, the autonomic nervous system. And then on the right are the triggers, whether they be PVCs or programmed stimulation at the time of an EP study. So what you would be measuring here are the modulating factors with MIBG, sympathetic innervation. You're also looking at the substrate, the size of the area of denervation, and LV function, and the heart size, and so on. So if you could bring in another parameter, modulating factor, whether it be heart rate variability or whatever.
You may have two pieces of the three parts of the triangle.
Yeah. Maybe I think we've already got two parts of the triangle, but maybe you could add to one of those parts by adding a second variable, both to modulating factors and to the substrate.
Yeah, it's challenging, but the stakes are high and the potential savings are large. So perhaps from
huge.
A cost perspective, it's worth it. But the stakes are very high.
Jim, do you know of any other trials that are ongoing at the moment?
Well, I think the one that I found interesting was the issue of the MRI interrogation of the myocardial substrate and gadolinium enhancement, trying to use that as a tool, particularly in people whose ejection fractions aren't in the range of the current indications, because the preliminary data look very promising.
And what about other trials of MIBG? Because we are going to need more. I mean, it's very promising. But as you pointed out right in the beginning, we need a negative predictive value pretty close to 100%.
Right. And so you can envision a trial where you do that kind of imaging and get a second physiologic parameter in patients who have ICDs, so you can follow them for a couple of years and see if you can pick out a group whose ICD didn't go off. I think you have to start there before a randomized trial to not put defibrillators in, because at the moment that's the standard of care.
Yeah, and that would be a very doable trial. I mean, there's no shortage of people with defibrillators,
right.
And it's just
that's
a question of measuring these parameters.
I agree.
Any other take-home messages for us? Not even necessarily related to MIBG, any other imaging and sudden death after heart failure
I think what we've learned over the years is how challenging these parameters are to translate not only into clinical practice, but from single center studies, you know, for instance, dysynchrony and CRT. I mean, how many single center study papers looked so good, and then a multi-center trial prospect doesn't look so good, even though physiologically it makes so much sense. So, you know, it's humbling, I think, is really the message.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. I must say, in a profession that is not characterized by humility, your philosophical approach is appreciated, and I'd really like to thank our audience, and I hope they found this interesting.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Cardiac Imaging to Predict Cardiac Events in Heart Failure Patients with and Without Preserved Ejection Fraction. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.